Now let me just say briefly before I start this, I got interested in the topic of storytelling when writing my book. Here it is, you've now seen it, if you haven't seen it before, Selling Out, Academic Freedom and the Corporate Market, because of the stories that were told to me by faculty, students and staff members when I interviewed them then, about their views of the ways in which the corporatization of the university is impinging upon both academic freedom and university autonomy, and I reported those in a number of case studies in the book. But that was really where, and then I began to think, well, what about teaching and learning? Couldn't that be, and it couldn't storytelling, and shouldn't storytelling be an integral part of that? So, when the title of my talk is, you may, Storytelling in University Education, Emotion, Teachable Moments, and the Value of Life. And one other caveat, I've got a paper here, and I've chopped huge, the good news is that I've chopped big chunks out of it to make it more palatable for you today. The bad news, however, is that I am actually going to read it. So bear with me on that too. All right, so here we go. The first section is, well, it's just an introduction. One way to understand teaching is as a process of storytelling about ourselves as professors and about the subjects we teach. On the one hand, we provide a narrative about our lives in the hope that our interests and passions will reach out to our students and enable them to become engaged learners. On the other, we tell stories about the subject matter itself, the reasons for its importance, the ways in which it has developed, the questions it poses of reality and social relations, the problems it may help to resolve, and even our own struggles to learn and to teach it. The purpose, I think, of both these aspects of storytelling is to humanize the process of learning by appealing to the student's imagination, so that they can consider themselves active participants in the pursuit of knowledge and feel empowered to tell stories about their own experience and deepen their own understanding of the subject. Storytelling, if this account is coherent in some way, storytelling then becomes central to learning itself as students are emboldened to provide narratives about narrative showing how knowledge comes alive for them. So my interest here in this paper is in the act of teaching as storytelling rather than narrative research about teaching, about which there's been an awful lot, and which I've said something in the bit I just chopped out. So my interest is more of the act of teaching as storytelling rather than narrative research about teaching. The aim is to understand how teaching and learning are forms of storytelling and how they might be improved by utilizing stories as their core. In other words, I'm more interested in university teachers as storytellers than in the research they conduct through narrative inquiry. And throughout this inquiry of mine, a predominant interest has been in the connection between storytelling in education and the value of life, and how the former can deepen, that is how storytelling can deepen our conceptions of life value, or the life value of life as both teachers and students. And later in the paper, as you'll see, I define life and life value as, let me see if I can remember it, organic movement, sentience and feeling, and thought. Those three aspects, organic movement, sentience and feeling, and thought. We'll come to that. So the next section I call Storytelling and Human Experience. In the oral traditions of indigenous peoples, stories are one of several ways in which knowledges are passed on by elders. The stories told are as diverse as the groups themselves, and they may have various purposes. As Joanne Archibald in this book, Indigenous Story Work, shows, Yeah, thank you. And this is a quote. Each Aboriginal nation has traditions, protocols and rules concerning stories and the way that stories are to be told for teaching and learning purposes. The types of stories can vary from the sacred to the historical, from cultural traditions to personal life experiences and testimonials. Some stories are just for fun, while others have powerful teachings. Some stories may be owned, those that are the responsibility of individuals, clans, or families. Some belong to the public domain, being available for anyone to tell. Some stories can be told only at certain times of the year. End quote. The different forms which stories take, the purposes they embody, the times when they can be told, and their public availability show just how central they are to Indigenous peoples. Precisely because they are at the core of our cultures, Archibald argues, quote, they have the power to make us think, feel, and be good human beings. They have the power to bring storied life back to us. End quote. Leading a good life involves leading a storied life, a life in which one's experience connects with the power of stories to engage the heart, mind, body, and spirit so that they are in balance with one another. Stories also emphasize the importance of balanced relationships with the land and among human beings, as Marie Batiste and Sahesh Henderson show, and they provide the spiritual understandings characterizing Indigenous value systems. Indigenous people's relationship with the land, they continue, as the source of life, reflects the recognition of the sacred nature of all living creatures sustained by the plenitude of the planet. The knowledge of passed on in storytelling is, as Sean Wilson shows, a relational process, one that includes all entities in the universe. It is with the cosmos, he writes. It is with the animals, with the plants, with the earth that we share this knowledge. Furthermore, storytelling has formed an integral part of traditional First Nations education in North America and elsewhere. And Eber Hampton shows that its holistic nature, quote, can be characterized as oral histories, teaching stories, ceremonies, apprenticeships, learning games, formal instruction, tutoring, and tag-along teaching, end quote. Now, Aboriginal author Thomas King, in this book, The Truth About Stories, believes that, quote, the truth about stories is that's all we are. It's a big claim. You can't understand the world without telling a story, as an Anishinaabe writer Gerald Wiesenthal tells us, there isn't any center to the world but a story. End quote. So the centrality of storytelling to the lives of Indigenous peoples and the oral traditions which sustain them cannot be overemphasized. But King goes even further, arguing that, quote, we live stories that either give our lives meaning or negate it with meaninglessness, end quote. And the we here seems to refer to humanity in general. As public acts shared with an audience, that's what King claims oral stories are. Oral stories are an important way of relating our experience by strengthening community and a sense of solidarity on the one hand, or alternatively, of demonstrating our alienation from the world and humankind on the other. Now, having said all that, if oral stories do indeed have the power to create community, why not use them in university teaching and learning? In doing so, however, we might well be engaging in acts of cultural appropriation from Indigenous peoples if theirs were the only stories upon which to draw. Fortunately, storytelling in either oral or written form is a practice shared among many peoples, and I'm just going to mention two. for the sake of time. In Celtic communities, for example, songs and stories are a way of retelling and reliving the past in order that oppression not be forgotten, usually from the English, so that its peoples can move forward, celebrating the present and imagining a different future, often by using wit and humor. And if any of you have had the opportunity to see, like I have, to see Billy Connolly, the Glaswegian comic, do his act for 2.5 hours, you'll know exactly what I mean by using wit and humor. He's unbelievable. Okay. I could go further, but I won't. And I'll say something later on about the UK, actually. Canadian and John Ralston Saul makes the following claim. He says that Canadian culture itself has been, he thinks that it has a strong oral tradition in general, in which public debate has informed the formulation of policy, an approach shared by some of the country's leading intellectuals, both Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal, and it's characterized by what he calls the humanist, the informal or flexible that belongs to the oral tradition. That's what he says. Okay. Next section, storytelling and the emotions. Now, some authors believe that the open-ended structure of both of storytelling reflects the ebb and flow of human experience in ways which make it particularly suitable as a pedagogical tool. I think that's true, but their argument begs a further question. What is it about stories that resonates with human experience at a fundamental level? Well, I think that Alfred North Whitehead's account is helpful here. Now, I didn't give his dates on the handout because I just assume everybody like me knows them, but he lived from 1861 to 1947. So I think Whitehead's account is helpful here. For he asserts that the core of experience is emotional, and that if we as faculty wish to connect with our students, we need to recognize this brute fact. As he puts it, in order for ideas to come alive, we should relate them, quote, to that stream compounded of sense perceptions, feelings, hopes, desires, and of mental activities adjusting thought to thought, which forms our life, end quote. Feelings, hopes, and desires comprise the deep emotional currents from which spring sensory awareness and the intellectual capacity to utilize ideas. As faculty, we need to connect the ideas we teach to the flowing stream of emotions at the core of our students' experience in order for them to appreciate their meaning. Failure to connect with the emotional and intellectual experience of our students results in what Whitehead calls inert ideas. That is to say, he says, ideas that are merely received into the mind without being utilized or tested or thrown into fresh combinations, end quote. So they become inert, they no longer move. Now, Whitehead's use of the metaphor of a stream, he uses that to indicate both the fluid and open-ended character of lived experience, undergirded by the deep currents of feeling and emotion which enable learning to take place. The stories which flow from the experience of teachers can provide an emotional connection to their students if they embody the passion for their subject which they still feel. Without this connection, the ideas being taught will tend to remain inert. Nevertheless, students who do connect to the professor's enthusiasm are more likely to find the ideas appealing because they correspond in some way to their own desires and aspirations. While stories emanating from faculty cannot elicit learning without strong emotional currents already flowing within the students themselves, they can provide the right kind of opportunity for self-expression and love of learning. Now, You might think, oh, that's all very well, but, you know, it sounds pretty nice philosophical theory, but, well, at least one study confirms the importance of emotion to learning. And I think there are many others, actually. My colleague Mark Flynn, together with another colleague from Finland, Hannu Soini, asked more than 230 students in the colleges of education at the universities of Saskatchewan and Aulu to give a concrete example of a situation in which you really learn something. By means of a constant comparative method, emotional significance emerged as the primary aspect of learning in the reports of almost two-thirds of the students, both Canadian and Finnish, male and female. Now, while their study is preliminary and any analysis of the results tentative, its goal, quote, was to evoke discussion and questions that might guide further research. Theoretical work about the relationship between emotion and learning and the importance of stories abounds. Parker Palmer, for example, supports both ideas in his book, I don't have it here, The Courage to Teach, for example, and in more recent work as well. Parker Palmer proposes that emotions are fundamental to the learning process and should be integrated with intellectual and spiritual understanding in any balanced approach to education. Palmer emphasizes what he calls the inner landscape of teaching as the experiential baseline for the pedagogical relationship. And by the concept of emotion, he means the way we and our students feel as we teach and learn, feelings that can either enlarge or diminish the exchange between us. Furthermore, stories, Palmer argues, can reach out to readers and students in ways that other explanations cannot. Stories, he says, are the best way to portray realities of this sort, and I'll say what this sort. So here is a tale of two people I have known whose lives can tell me more about the subtleties of what he calls identity and integrity than any theory could. Now, while he does go on to explain the concepts of identity and integrity as the growing capacity to understand oneself, that's identity, on the one hand, and the realization of one's potential for wholeness on the other, that's integrity, Palmer illustrates the ways in which they can be enhanced or expunged by telling a story about two contrasting characters from his own experience. So here we go, a story to tell, to explain this conceptual distinction. One, he says, became a self-divided, engaged in a civil war, so that his teaching devolved into combat rather than craft, while the other brought great generosity to his teaching and research and the same sense of craft as his rural forebears who had worked with metal and wood. So the contrast between fragile identity and alienation on the one hand, a self-divided, and open identity and integrity and integration on the other, feeling one with one's craft, are underscored in graphic manner by the use of a relatively simple story. So he kind of concludes on this point that an integral part of good teaching is the use of storytelling, which enables faculty to reveal their identities to students, bridge the divide too often secured by status, and provide them, that is students, with opportunities to learn by grasping concepts from real life situations to which they can relate. Okay, so much for emotion and stories. Now, the next section is on teachable moments. And I've called it teachable moments as learning opportunities, and they're reflected in a student's story, one of my students' stories, actually. So there may be times when when teaching and the process of storytelling culminate in what are called teachable moments. That's the kind of jargon, right? I mean, that's the educators. Teachable moments. Those joyful events in the rhythm of teaching and learning, when previously hidden connections are established, however fleetingly, among participants and the subject matter. Now, Jim Garrison, who's going to be here next month, he calls these teachable moments an almost ineffable experience. And he waxes lyrically in his book, Dewey and Eros, about teachable moments. And I got the quotation here, but I'm not gonna read it to you, but I am gonna draw your attention to the metaphors that he uses in order to describe teachable moments. They are all organic metaphors. I'm going to say more about teachable moments in the later on, but I want to draw your attention to the organic metaphors here. He describes teachable moments as what I think are learning opportunities. They are relational spaces opening up a dynamic rhythm in which each pedagogical partner dances with the other, enabling the student to experience an effortless flow in learning, and the teacher to use their intuition to understand their significance. I believe, actually, as I've kind of intimated, that teachable moments are actually better understood as learning opportunities. Why? Because they involve an energetic flow, conjoining, connecting students with each other, with the subject matter, and possibly with the professor. We'll see why possibly in just a minute. Now, the process through which teachable moments can occur, I'm going to illustrate by a story from my own experience as a university teacher a few years ago, in which a student's imagination caught fire and created a valuable learning opportunity for her. So several years ago, during the fall semester, I was teaching a course on history and philosophy of education, in which we had been discussing the importance of democracy, both in the work of John Dewey and the community schools of Saskatchewan. With some guidance on my part, sometimes prodding, no, guidance, the class of 35 students decided to go outside on a bright, sunny October day. This is in Saskatoon, okay? It's not in Vancouver, in Saskatoon. To continue our discussion. One of the students later described her experience when writing about it in a final exam and then gave me permission to use it in my research. I am going to read this quotation. Holistic experiences happen when one is completely involved on every level of one's being. The walls of a classroom can feel confining and create containment. The experience of having a class outside was quite mind-blowing. I realized that all of the important resources from which I had been trained to cut myself off as a person, a teacher, and student were out in nature. My senses heard the birds, felt the sunlight on my cheek, and I smelled the leaves. I was totally alive and connected to the world. I noticed a leaf on the picnic table, and someone had written a word on it. Another leaf fell on the table, and I made a drawing on it. I was experiencing an organic union with nature and with other students' ideas and felt part of a group experience. We were creating community in a class that I had not felt before. End quote. Now, some people hearing this description might infer that the student was actually distracted from learning by being outside in nature, by the birds, by the sunlight, and the falling leaves. But that's not her view. Rather, she experienced feelings of being fully alive that connected her with other students. Together, they were creating a sense of community by discussing ideas in a way she had not experienced before. And this was made possible by a feeling of organic union That's her, those are her words. An experience of relatedness that infused her appreciation for the beauty of nature and the rich potentiality of the world of ideas. The freedom of being outside on a sunny day enabled the student to discover new insights in a joyful manner, which re-engaged her love for ideas. As a student of art education, she was especially aware of the aesthetic aspects of the outdoor experience, which strengthened her imagination and the possibilities which nature offered for her learning and development as a teacher. Now, it's true that some of the other students were not quite as, didn't wax quite as eloquent as she did. They were a bit concerned about it. But, okay, but they thought it was interesting. Okay. All right. To some extent, the student's description reflects the understanding of teachable moments proposed by Garrison. Hers was an experience that took place on several levels. She felt an organic union with nature. A holistic feeling of connectedness to the natural world, to what Lao Tzu calls those myriad creatures, which she recognized as having the potential to deepen her learning. She also experienced living connections with her colleagues' ideas, which were shared in new ways, allowing them to flow together, a process which created novel relationships and a growing sense of community. Okay, next section. Imagination and aesthetic value in stories as teachable moments. Imagination and aesthetic value in stories as teachable moments. So in order to understand teachable moments as learning opportunities more fully, I consider the following questions. How do the imagination and aesthetic appreciation of students actually emerge in the process of storytelling and teachable moments? And to what extent are stories and teachable moments comparable as learning opportunities? Because if indeed storytelling and teachable moments do engage students in these ways by enhancing the range of their comprehension, their imagination, and their aesthetic appreciation, they can serve to strengthen what I'm going to go on to talk about, namely the value of their lives. So teachable moments, I think, as if you consider them as learning opportunities, they seem to involve both students' imagination and their aesthetic appreciation. And I'm going to illustrate this by means of another story, not this time from one of my students, but from one of the stories told by a student to Mark Flynn and Hannu Soini in the course of their research on the role of emotion. Because I think it illustrates this process of aesthetic appreciation, students' imagination in teachable moments quite well. Now, this student had recently taken a poetry course on human beings' relationship with nature, in which the professor encouraged students to develop their own ideas about poetry, right, and its relationship to human nature. On the basis of this intellectual freedom and the joy which accompanied it, a paradigm shift occurred for this student. Quote, "From this I learned that the arts provide a whole new way to look at life on Earth. Science, for example, provides a very efficient way to approach and deal with our environment. The arts provide a unique way to look at the world from different perspectives and develop conclusions and realities about the world we live in today." End quote. The freedom of inquiry which this student experienced provided the conditions for his imagination to thrive, as he came to realize how poetry and the arts could furnish a new understanding of the planet and our relationship to it. While science frames laws and theories that increase human beings' understanding and control over nature, poetic sensibilities open up new vistas in which diverse alternatives are made possible. As Whitehead puts it, the student's imagination was engaged in an intellectual adventure. a journey leading to an imaginative grasp of the transformative power of the arts. Invited by his professor to share in the adventures of ideas, he was able to pursue the freshness, zest, and the extra keenness of intensity that arise from an open process of discovery in which freedom and spontaneity give rise to a search for new perfections. This search for new ideals engaged the student's imagination by eliciting an intellectual survey of alternative possibilities. That's Whitehead's conception of imagination. A process which enabled him to construct an intellectual vision of a new world and preserve the zest of life. The zest of life by the suggestion of satisfying purposes, end quote. So the student's story, I think, reveals that deeply satisfying purposes could express themselves awakened by the aesthetic experience of poetic form. His conception of human's relationship with nature had changed profoundly as its beauty was revealed in the verse of different authors. And in Garrison's terms, the freedom of inquiry enjoyed by the student enabled him to enjoy what Garrison calls a pause in a larger process which matched the rhythms of nature. There was indeed, I think, an asymmetry between the growth in the ways the student was learning and the dynamic presence of nature which revealed itself through the form of art. And I'm not alone in saying that. I have to say John Dewey says that in his work Art as Experience. So just in terms of this section, the two examples I've given from my own student and the student who was studying poetry are all of student stories in which they tell us about how they really learn something. And each story grew out of significant occasions, whether they occurred inside or outside the classroom, or took place over a period of time. And I think these teachable moments are learning occasions in which there's a convergence in the rhythm of learning, as Garrison says, an organic process in which faculty's participation as storytellers can be, at least, a key element. Why? Because narratives about similar occasions from our experience, whether as students, teachers, or researchers, can bring the subject matter to life in ways that appeal to the imagination of their students and appeal and enable them to construct a new vision of the world and how they might change it as, for example, future teachers. 4. And I'm going to quote John Dewey again, but this time from Democracy and Education. As he suggests, teachable moments as learning occasions strengthen, quote, the power to grow. We do not have to draw out or reduce positive activities from students, as some educational doctrines would have. Where there is life, there are already eager and impassioned activities. Growth is not something done to them, it is something they do. End quote. Human beings have a capacity to learn, which unfolds as a process of growth that characterizes life itself. The value of students' lives increases as the range of their emotional, intellectual, imaginative, and aesthetic understanding becomes both broader and deeper. The passionate activities at the base of this process require careful nurturing by educators, not regimes of conditioning. Now, I could actually end there, but I'm not actually going to, because I haven't said anything about about the value of life. I can see you're all getting a bit woozy, and I am going to read this bit too, because this is this last section. So we're getting near the end. Okay, we're getting near the end. All right, this last section, truth. Nothing. I mean, you get a big picture here. Truth and life. In stories contesting the global market. Truth and life in stories contesting the global market. I mean, what? In 5 pages or so. Okay. Can storytelling change the world? Well, Thomas King certainly hopes it can. He writes, stories are a kind of medicine, he writes. A story told one way could cure, while the same story told another way could injure. And as a result, he says, you have to be careful with the stories you tell. You have to be careful with the stories you tell. End quote. There are many ways in which stories can cause harm. And one of them, I believe, is when they fail to tell the truth. While it would be foolish, if not impossible, for faculty to insist on students telling true stories, I mean, how could we possibly know, right, if they were telling true stories? We should strive to do so in the hope that it inspires them to do the same. Truth, that is, conceived not in absolute terms, but as a process in which, as Whitehead argues, quote, the growth of reason is the increasing importance of critical judgments in the discipline of imaginative enjoyment. What does that mean? Okay, end quote. This is what I think he means. In order to reach this kind of truth, a process of inquiry founded on the value of critique should be counterbalanced by the joy and playfulness of the imagination, about which I've said. And this imagination, in turn, finds a rooted discipline in the facts of experience. Truth and rationality are necessary conditions for a pedagogy, I believe, capable of challenging the global market in the name of a value system which upholds human and planetary life as sovereign. And I think as educators, we're actually faced with this problem. Now, journalist Kate Calloway, recounts her experience of telling a true story about her own poetry in front of complete strangers in a London pub, where people gather together on a weekly basis to listen to the narratives of others. The performers are all required to tell true stories from their own experience. The title of these occasions is True Stories Told Live. A basic attraction of the event, Calloway claims, is that we have a hunger for truth. We want people to reveal themselves. Because of the overabundance of new technologies that mediate communication in the global market. At the same time, she acknowledges that what is fascinating about these evenings is their miscellaneous harmony, as the stories weave together, integrating their diversity into creative unity reminiscent of the dancing figures in teachable moments. Now, Whitehead, paradoxical as he is, seems to abandon the concept of truth when claiming the following. It's more important that a proposition be interesting than that it be true. Ooh. It's an interesting thing to say, especially for educators. The energy embodied in a proposition, he argues, as an integral part of an actual lived experience, constitutes both its interest and importance. A proposition, moreover, can be quite diverse. A notion, he says, about actualities, a suggestion, a theory, a supposition about things, end quote, all of which could be included in a story. On the other hand, Whitehead writes, but of course, a true proposition is more apt to be interesting than a false one. Also, action in accordance with the emotional lure of a proposition is more apt to be successful if the proposition is true. And apart from action, the contemplation of truth has an interest of its own. But after all this explanation and qualification, it remains true that the importance of a proposition lies in its interest. Work that one out. End quote. What I think he's saying is this. In both theory and practice, a true story that emerges, in the course of teaching and learning, a true story is likely to be to be interesting, more interesting and creative, sorry, more interesting than a false one. While it remains, from his perspective, almost a tautology that a proposition in such a story should interest students, we should always try to interest students, a critical understanding of reality requires that it be true. And this particularly so if Whitehead's injunction to enable students to utilize their imagination in proposing alternatives to the status quo be followed in our teaching. After all, there are several writers, contemporary writers, such as Bill Hare and Ronald Glasberg, who have said that truth and honesty are preconditioned for the trust required in any pedagogical relationship where students learn to exert critical judgment. You need truth and honesty for that to happen. Teachable moments as learning opportunities are unlikely to occur unless they are confident that faculty are engaged in the truth of teaching or loving, which is a process of long and difficult inquiry. That's Garrison. He compares teaching with loving for a number of reasons, which we could go into if you like. Without our sharing true stories about the need for community in a globalized world where self-interest has become the defining logic of value, where we don't share true stories in such a world, the potential for ethical understanding is negated. Only when students can distinguish between appearance and reality are they likely to understand the significance of the following questions. Are the representations of the market system true to the world and their own claims? Or is their reality different from and opposed to their appearance? So are the representations of the market system we get on in the media, for example, true to the world and to the claims they are making? Or is the reality of those claims, of those representations, different from and opposed to their appearance? Is there some kind of disjunction between them? Are there, in other words, true stories hidden beneath the fabulations and monetary exchanges of the global market, which can be uncovered by means of critical and imaginative inquiry? And if so, could students engage in the pursuit of knowledge as a vital activity in which they imagine new possibilities and evaluate them in the light of emergent facts formerly obscured by the dross of falsehood? Fine, but the question still remains. Which theory of truth could best accommodate such storytelling with our students, many of whom are already well aware of the plight of the planet and the ways in which the global market contributes to poverty and injustice? Now, I'm arguing for what I'm calling a process theory which takes into account the value of life. And as I said earlier, the value of life I'm defining as organic movement, sentience and feeling, and thought. And so the process theory which takes into account the value of life independent of its use for making money provides a valuable way forward. Now, John McMurtry, in a recent article, which I don't have here actually, yes I do have here, advocates just such a theory in the following terms. As we come to understand that truth is always a process of more coherently inclusive taking into account, and life coordinates are what must always be taken into account to be consistent with our terrestrial condition, reason awakes, end quote. So I'm going to explain what I think he means by that. A conception of truth as an evolving process that is never complete enables us to recognize stories, including those claiming to be scientific, as true to the extent that they provide a coherent and an increasingly coherent and inclusive account of the events they describe. Okay. Wise and rational storytelling requires reference to those coordinates which sustain and promote human and planetary life. Clean air and water, nutritious food and shelter, forest ecosystems, and diverse species, as well as all those institutions like public education and public health care which enable human growth, for they are all at risk from the market's insatiable drive to maximize stockholder value. Only stories whose framework is rich enough to include facts and statements consistent with these life requirements can help students and faculty to understand how to uphold and promote the value of life by recognizing that life's growth is the ethical sovereign and is to be protected and develop as the first priority of society. So that's human and non-human life, the planetary life. Now, by way of contrast with such a conception of truth and such a value system, where life coordinates are excluded a priori, stories are likely to fall within the currently ruling paradigm, namely what McMurtry calls the money sequence of value. And the money sequence of value deploys life and lives as its means. It seeks only to maximize money possession and is ultimately an irrational choice sequence because it leaves all life requirements out of account. It eventually leads, as it now has, to the collapse of life support systems through generational time. End quote. So, the narrow frame of the money sequence of value, which is money, life as means to more money, and this is all privately owned money, reduces all life to an instrument for the private accumulation of more money. By ruling out the requirements for life, referred to above, the money sequence reveals its irrationality by hastening the collapse of life-sustaining systems directly attributable to its life-blind logic. I'm getting very near the end. Storytelling, which incorporates true accounts of the value of life, independent of its use for maximizing private money profits, now becomes an imperative. Stories of this kind form the basis of a renewed pedagogy capable of providing hope to the lives of students and faculty alike as they recognize both their own worth and that of others outside the parameters of the corporate market. In the contemporary university, for example, where we are right now, where students are reduced to customers, and collegial decision-making has been wrested from the hands of faculty by central administrators, to a large extent. To a large extent. I'm not looking. Yeah. The belief in collective demographic, the belief, at least at my university, and I've seen it at other universities, and maybe not here, the belief in collective democratic action is evaporating. Okay, all right. I'm sad to tell. However, true stories, in the sense I've argued for, become a tool for challenging pessimism and asserting a life-enhancing value system, one that embraces both a different kind of university, where knowledge can be shared in the public interest, and a world in which the diversity of species and cultures is fully recognized. As David Smith at the University of Alberta puts it, and I quote, most especially, there has to be a retelling of the historical tales, such as the others who have been silenced under the triumphant narratives of empire are given their just due and embraced as necessarily contributive to any future worth sharing. Aboriginals, women, landless peasants in Africa and Latin America, exploited workers in the new economy, all these have something to bring to the truth that is yet to be revealed, end quote. We in the Academy should be listening to historical and contemporary stories about the ways in which different groups have been denied a voice by colonialism and neocolonialism, indigenous peoples and peasants throughout the world, especially women who barely scrape together a living in the global economy, and many others who face growing unemployment and destitution. Their words must be heard in order for truth to emerge as a process of more coherently taking into account the lives of all members of the human species. Only then can a dialogue take place in which their understandings play a significant part in promoting the value structures capable of supporting life on this planet. Without their guidance about how best to conduct ourselves, the relentless plundering of planetary systems and the pauperization of humankind will continue apace. The issue becomes one of the will to act, or more accurately, the will to act in solidarity with the oppressed.